Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
This episode was recorded for my UK column show. Please keep us independent by going to support.ukcolumn.org.
This is Germ Warfare, the battle of ideas.
Austrian economics is consistent and has been consistent since its inception.
That's an interesting word, consistent. I'd say, I'm not sure I would use that word, but I don't think it's inaccurate. I would say that Austrian economics has tended to be stick closer to reality than most of the other schools out there. So I guess that corresponds in a way to consistency. But I think it's important for when trying to understand the whole problem, the whole situation, it's important to grasp the fact that economists, as sort of representatives of the academic world that are tasked with explaining to people how the world works, they have to sort of, they have to be kind of careful what they say, because most of them are paid by schools. And that, in many cases, goes back to government money. So if you say things that the government doesn't like, you may risk losing your livelihood. And in fact, if you look at where economists get their money, particularly 10, 15 years ago, most economists in the West were all on the payroll of, direct on the payroll of governments, for example, on the payroll of either government-funded institutions or central banks. So they were not free to speak freely. and I think even the Austrian school, which has been more daring than the rest, is still also bound by that, by those restrictions, by those limitations. On average, they have been less bound, perhaps because they were already very marginalized for a long time. And as a result, they really didn't have much to lose. They were pretty much excluded from the mainstream of academia for many decades, although historically, they were much more mainstream. And the origins of the Austrian school, as probably many listeners can guess, goes back to Austria. In Austria, it was certainly the leading school of economics in the 1900s and the late 1900s. And many of the central concepts that are very mainstream in economics today were invented by Kant, work first conceived of by the Austrian school. For example, time preference. That's probably not something that necessarily all listeners will understand, but it's basically the idea that how much I am willing to how much I'm willing to put off for the future instead of consuming it today. So for example, children tend to have very, very high time preference. They want to have things now. You say, well, you can have twice as much if you wait a year. Well, that's not going to fly with most kids. But as they get older, then their time preference tends to drop. They're able to delay gratification. And that's a very central concept in economics. That actually came from the Austrian school. Also, concepts like marginal utility might ring a bell to some that have studied economics. Also is a concept that comes from the Austrian school. So a lot of those things became part of what is now mainstream economics without people really realizing it came from the Austrian school. But the Austrian school kind of went underground in, I guess, the 40s or 50s, when, let's say, the socialist type of thinking became very dominant in not only in the East, but also in the West. The idea that governments should interfere in markets, that governments should direct things, became very dominant, and that kind of led the Austrian school to be very, very much marginalized, and so much so that by the 1970s and 80s, it was almost completely forgotten. And in fact, if you take my own example, I studied economics on the border of Austria in Germany, in Passau, which is a little city on the border of Austria. One of the leading early thinkers from the Austrian school was a man named Eugen von Böhm-Bawerk, and he was on the Austrian money. He was on the Austrian 100 shilling note. And so I spent a lot of time in Austria, and I saw him every day whenever I looked at those notes, but I had no idea he was actually one of the early thinkers in the Austrian school. And I studied economics. I didn't know anything about it. So I didn't even hear the word Austrian economics until long after I graduated, which is, of course, absurd, given the fact that I went to study the economics, I don't know, 300 kilometers from Vienna, where it comes from. But it just goes to show you how marginalized it was. So I got lost. What was your question again? Remind me.
Well, no, I mean, you're actually kind of segueing into what I want to know, and that is, what is Austrian economics? So if you, in a general setting, say Austrian economics, people don't really know what you mean. But you've kind of alluded to the fact that it's based on sort of the basic axiom that we do things with a purpose. We want to achieve a certain goal. And because we want to do that, we don't... I'm sorry?
You said it better than I did. That's kind of that's the central axiom, yes.
Yeah,
how do people go about doing that?
And
observing through reality what actually goes on. I guess one way of defining one of the key concepts is the difference between what we call economic and political means to obtain goals. So economic means is defined as obtaining benefit through voluntary interaction, voluntary exchange, through producing things. And political means, to put it crudely, you could say was obtaining goods and benefits through ulterior means. For example, stealing them. That might be one way. We could also call that taxation, for example. And if I get paid by the government, or the government grants me some privilege, then I can gain through those so-called political means. And of course, that is considered sensitive content. So it's not something that is talked about much in universities, for example, or in the media, for understandable reasons. And certainly when I went to school, there was never any hint that we were never told anything about these political means and economic means, for example, for understandable reasons. But if you really look at it, then you see that much of the wealth in society is, in fact, generated through these political means and not through economic means. It's, in fact, if you look at the recent history of the world in the last 50 years since, to put it exactly, 1971, when the United States went off the gold standard, and the rest of the world being tied to the dollar, essentially went off the gold standard with the United States, and everyone started printing money faster and faster and faster. And money printing, that's one of the, I guess, key sensitive insights that the Austrian school has continued to teach, is that money printing is, in essence, also a kind of theft. You're robbing their entire society through this money printing, and it's going into the pockets of a small group. The once you see that, you realize that that is at the heart of so many of the problems we have in society. And you can say, well, there are all these good reasons for it. Okay, we need the money to put the money to pay welfare or whatever, or subsidize industry, all these things. But the net result is that you have people like often cited Elon Musk, everyone's favorite example is, oh, look, Elon Musk, he's worth $1 trillion. And that's so unfair. I personally don't think that is unfair that he is worth $1 trillion. I think it's his own accomplishment. But if there weren't all this money printing going on in the background, it would never happen. There's no way he would be worth $1 trillion if all this money printing were not going on in the background. And then the answer that's given by the people that don't grasp the theft that's going on here in the background is to say, oh, well, let's just tax the rich, right? Instead of fixing the root of the problem, which is the money printing. And taxing the rich has never worked because the rich are the people that are the best situated to avoid taxation. So who ends up getting taxed? The middle class. But this is once again the difference in the reality on the ground and what we're told, right? We're told, oh, we want to tax the rich because there's this discrepancy of rich and poor, and we need the money for all these different things. So let's tax the rich. It sounds nice, but that's not what is actually going on in reality. The rich are not the ones that are paying. And once again, you're trying to fix a problem that was created by money printing. As long as you don't fix the source of the problem, you're never going to get anywhere. The other, of course, that would happen is if there weren't all this money printing, we wouldn't have all these wars going on at the same time either, because all the money printing is used to finance the wars. Right? Sorry, I got a little off topic here. But yeah, but to get back to the issue of what economics can do for the world and for each individual person, it gives us a framework to understand what's going on. And that's really, I think, the most valuable thing about Austrian economics is it gives its adherents and those who studied its lessons a, let's say, toolkit for better understanding the world. And of course, other branches of economics do that to a certain extent as well. But because they are inherently less honest due to the fact that they're most of them are bound into the mainstream, it's much harder for them to do that because they're hiding this big problem out there that's causing all these issues. And that's the money printing. And of course, not the only problem, but it's, in my opinion, the major problem, the number one problem that's causing all these issues. And because of that, if you lack that key insight, I'd say it's very hard to figure out what's going on or how to make things better.
But now, Scott, you and I both know that Elon isn't a trillionaire by his own making.
I'll challenge you. What do you mean by that?
Nah, he's probably propped up, but I guess that goes into other discussions.
Sure, no, but I mean, he learned how to play the game.
Yes.
He's certainly a very talented person. I don't think he cheated necessarily within the rules of the game, but the problem is the game is rigged.
Exactly.
But that's not his fault. He just did a good job of playing the game, right? And people that fault him for it, I think they're a little bit off track. It's not, he didn't come up with this system, you know? He just played it, right?
If you say that one of the major problems is the money printing, how do you get around that?
What do you mean? How do we get around that?
Well, you can't really trade in pieces of gold and silver. It's just too inconvenient.
Oh well, sure. Okay. Well, but that's, you're talking about technicality. Sure, we can trade in digital tokens of some form or another. But the problem is that governments have abrogated the right for themselves to print endless numbers of these tokens. That leads to obviously to inflation, and it means that they can finance things they otherwise would not be able to finance, like wars, for example, that they could not finance if they didn't have that ability. But you have this ever growing gap between rich and poor, or the richer and the poorer, in pretty much all of the industrialized world, and including China as well. And the reason you have that is because of what's called, the pretty word for it is financialization, right? And that, but what is financialization? It really just means there's more and more hot money floating around, pursuing ever smaller amounts of goods. So people, the upper 5% or whatever, they're accumulating more and more of these, of this ever larger amounts of this hot money, whereas the bottom 50% have next to nothing. And once again, this would not exist without all that hot money being created.
But now, I've heard some people make the argument that pinning the printed money to, say, gold, like what the gold standard was, doesn't make any difference. Do you think it does?
What do you mean? What doesn't make any difference?
The gold standard, for example.
Well, if you had any standard that money, that any hard standard that money were tied to, be it Bitcoin or gold or silver, with a limited, I mean, gold is produced and silver is produced, but in limited quantities. So yes, that would definitely make a huge difference because they couldn't finance the wars. I'd say that's the biggest difference, but there are lots of other things that would be forced to find an equilibrium. And I guess that's particularly if you look, and this is a topic maybe we'll get to later, is the whole, this huge economic disequilibrium in the world right now. But that equilibrium could not be sustained without this endless printing of various forms of digital tokens, you know, call them dollars or yen or euros or whatever. And they're all doing it, right? I mean, in this case, people talk about the conflict between China and the West or whatever, or Russia, but they're all doing the same thing, right? They're all dependent on the same system. None of them want to give the system up, understandably, of course. And they're all there, and it really, this wild track we're on right now got started in 2008, even though you could argue it started in 1971, but it really got started with a vengeance in 2008 when all the major central banks of the world got together and said, we're all risking them. How are we going to get over this crisis? We're going to print an enormous amount of money. And that way, if they all print together, then it won't be too obvious to the population, because their exchange rates between each other won't change that much because they're all printing at a clip of about roughly 10 to 12% per year. And it varies from area to area. There's the Eurozone, China, US, but let's say roughly most of them are around 10% a year, right? Now these days, China is about 15%. So it's getting worse and worse, but it's the same thing that's going on everywhere. And none of them want to give it up. But the disequilibrium, the imbalances are getting larger and larger and larger. And at some point, something's got to give here.
So, I mean, if your currency is pegged to something like gold, right, which is stable because it's literally being dug out the ground and you can weigh it and count.
Well, you can dig up a certain amount every year, but it's limited, right? And you can't.
Correct.
If some government wants to go to war in, let's say, Iran, well, how are they going to pay those bills, right? Well, they need dig faster, start digging.
But what happens now is that it's now regulated by policy, so they can just adjust the policy.
No, they just tell their central bank to turn the switch and print up some more dollars. But they could, if it were pinned to gold or to Bitcoin or whatever, they couldn't do that. But of course, that's not going to happen. They're not going to pin it to gold. They're not going to pin it to Bitcoin. They're going to keep those as reserve currencies so they can devalue their paper currencies against, which is what's going on right now.
Which is also why they do. So in South Africa, we do something called inflation targeting.
Oh yeah, I don't know. I don't know the situation out there. You tell me.
Well, what they do is they adjust inflation first, and then everything follows that.
Well, yeah, it sounds like what they had in Brazil for a long time, this crawling peg, which was a disaster from what I know.
Yeah. It doesn't end well.
You're essentially, I mean, and you're also, I mean, there's so many examples, but let's just start with who pays, who comes, who has the, what's the word? How do you say it in English? The short end of the stick. The who ends up losing in this is, for one thing, the retirees. They lose out, most of them, because most of them are holding their savings in some sort of form that's not being adjusted for inflation, or maybe they're, and particularly until a couple of years ago, when they had the zero interest rate policy, they were getting, you know, 1%, 0.1%, nothing on their savings. And meanwhile, the money supply was being blown up by 10% every year. So they are losing 10%. So large numbers of retirees all across the West have all ended up in poverty because their savings aren't worth anything. I mean, it's pretty evil, right? but it's the inevitable result, because the only way to protect yourself against the inflation is essentially play the asset markets. And you can do it, but it takes effort and time and skill. And most people don't have all those. And so they end up losing out. It's a very unfair setup. I mean, it's nice for the people that know how to do it. I know how to do it. Nice for me, but not nice for the most of the world.
Another interesting Austrian economics characteristic is its opposition to artificially low interest rates, if I'm correct. South Africa's interest rate at the moment, I think, is around 9 or 10, 11%, somewhere there. I think in the US, it's pretty much close to zero, same as Canada.
No. The US now, they decreased it, but it's now, what, 3 or 4%, something like that.
But those are still artificially low.
Sure. Well, it's artificially, we should define that. What artificially means there is it's less than the growth of the money supply. And so if you're, like here in China right now, they're growing the money supply about 15% a year. And we have an interest rates of, I don't know, 2 or 3%. So you see those interest rates are, whoever is borrowing money at those rates, including us, we also got a nice big fat, we got so big fat loans from the banks recently. And we're paying, how much are we paying? 3%? 2.5%? Something like that? Wait. Why is it bad? Well, because only certain members of society get that. Most people don't get that, or they get it only in very small amounts. If you're Amazon, for example, you can borrow unlimited amounts of money at the official interest rate, and if the real inflation rate is 10%, essentially you're getting a subsidy. Because if you only break even, essentially, and you grow with the money supply, then you'll get 10%, and you're only paying 5, so you're getting 5%, and you're getting it off of the back of the rest of society. It's not evenly distributed who gets to benefit from those interest rates. I mean, it sounds nice, but in reality, it just contributes to making the gap between the rich and the poor ever larger. It contributes to impoverishing the retirees. It impoverishes everybody who has savings unless they're able to play this game. We have a good counterexample out there right now, and that is Russia. So Russia is running a substantial deficit, public deficit right now, because of the war. They have to finance the war. But they're actually doing it, I would argue, the right way. So they have said, okay, we can't do anything about the deficit, but what we can do is we can keep the interest rates high. So they basically have a relatively honest interest rate regime to reflect the reality, and they're paying 18% interest, which is substantially more than everyday inflation, and it's even more than the money supply is being increased. So there's actually a huge incentive for Russians to save. Which is the way it should be, right? So of course, some Russian entrepreneurs and companies complain, oh, we don't have money to invest because the interest is too high. Well, you have a competition. Who can be the most productive? And if you want to get rubles in Russia, you need to be able to pay at least the 18%. Yeah, that's like your minimum threshold of productivity or your return. You have to have at least 18% of mine and plus something on top to make it worth your while. Otherwise, forget about it. So it narrows down the field, and it ends up, the economy ends up supporting the people that have the higher returns. So that breeds efficiency. Whereas you have the opposite going on in the U.S., particularly in the U.S., where there's a lot of easy money around at effectively negative interest rates, negative real interest rates. And the people that have access to it, the particularly like these days, the people that are financing all these AI product projects, they're spending billions and tens, hundreds of billions of dollars on these things that's coming down like magic from the sky. And they don't have to, if they can do, you know, 4% return, if that, then it's worthwhile. It's because there's not enough competition. Whereas, interestingly enough, in China, although we have very relatively low interest rates here, I mentioned earlier, I think it's like 3%, which is really, it's actually real negative interest rates. And it has led to a lot of capital flight. So people basically look elsewhere to invest their money because the returns are so bad here in China. And it's had the ironic effect because so much of the money has gone to the Wall Street casino that inside China, it's hard to get money to investor money. So Chinese investors, particularly people like in the AI area, are forced to be much more efficient. Like they have to be really good because they're not getting the money. They have to find a way of doing it very efficiently. So actually being pushed towards efficiency in China one way, in Russia another way, is a good thing. And you look at DeepSeek as the best example of that. For listeners that may not know, DeepSeek is a Chinese AI venture that was kind of made a lot of headlines about a year ago with their breakthrough model. It was all financed by a private hedge fund. It got no safe studies, no external investment. Their breakthrough was really they were 10, 20, some say 100 times more efficient than what ChatGPT was doing. And now they did it because they were bootstrapping it. So basically the answer to your question is what low interest rates do tendentially is they don't breed efficiency. They breed laziness. To get the money. Yeah.
However, as a counter to that, here in South Africa during apartheid, particularly in the 1980s, which was the height of apartheid, interest rates peaked at around 24%. I mean, that's not sustainable.
Well, I guess it depends what was the money supply growing at the time?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. But I mean, that was largely to do with sanctions and all kinds of other restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's hard.
That's difficult. I mean, if you buy a property, you have to then you end up paying a quarter of that property's price eventually on top of what you paid.
Well, there must have been a lot of money printing going on at the time. I can't believe that was happening without the money printing background. So yeah, but the money printing makes everything very complicated. Without money printing, that could not have happened. There's no way you could have a 24% interest rate without heavy money printing going on. I mean, just no society would produce that result without basically the money being devalued constantly. Mm. I mean, maybe 2,000 years ago, they say, I think in early Rome, some say the interest rate was 12%. And this is reflecting much higher time preferences than we have today. And that was an era of relatively hard money. But 12% is, by modern standards, in terms of real interest rates, it's very high. But this was 2,000 years ago. These days, that a real interest rate of 12%, unheard of. Absolutely unheard of. So I without knowing the details, I would guess the root of the problem in South Africa, of course, sanctions, whatever, all these reasons why we had to print the money, right? And you can argue that here or there. You can say, well, we had no other choice. Okay, well, maybe. But regardless of what the reason was, the results are inevitable if you print the money. And that is one of those central insights, I think, of Austrian economics that the school is always stuck with, is insisting upon that. It doesn't matter what your excuse is. I mean, maybe it's a good excuse, maybe it's a bad excuse, but the results are a logical upshot of what, you know, garbage in, garbage out. You put this in, then you're going to get something, you're going to get that out.
Well, yes, your answer. While you were talking, I quickly looked it up. During the 1980s, South Africa experienced substantially higher growth in broad money supply compared to its trading partners. This excessive monetary expansion was a key factor in keeping South African inflation persistently high throughout most of the 1980s, even as other countries were successfully bringing the inflation rates down. So there you go. It's exactly what you said.
Right. And of course, that's what the U.S. did in the early 80s. They finally stopped their inflationary policies of the 70s, and they introduced high interest rates. And they did pretty much what Russia did 2 years ago. They got the ship back on track. There were some tough years there where the interest rates were 12, 15%. But they got, within a couple of years, things got back on track, and the economy settled down and it started growing again. When you're trying to deal with the result of massive money printing, the shock is painful. It's true, initially, but then interest rates come down. Like I said, you can talk about it from a normative perspective, what's better and what's worse, but you can't alter the fact that these have clear effects. And when you choose, and the ultimate example of the most extreme example that we know of is this the so-called zero interest rate policy, the ZIRP, which was followed by Europe and the United States from 2010 roughly until 2022, roughly 12 years. And that was just disastrous. It was huge. And one of the most obvious results of that disaster was this enormous gap between rich and poor in Europe and in the United States. And in China, we didn't have that problem as much until recently. It was only in a couple of years ago that they dropped the interest rates this low. Typically through that period, Chinese interest rates were around 6%. Roughly, so the government was printing 10% a year or 11% a year. Interest rates were at 6, so they were 5 negative. Whereas in the West, it was 10 negative. So the West was considerably worse. At least in China, the interest rates were that far below that they were not that negative. But in the West, it was extremely negative, and that just skewed everything to no end. Whereas now in China, actually now they're following the example of the West, and now they're skewing it even more. And we're, of course, getting the same bad results here.
Another important vector of the Austrian school of economics is its opposition to centralization. It prefers decentralized models, and it also has a strong emphasis on property rights. Now, I remember when I was in Shanghai and I met up with you and I asked you, what is it that turned China around in the last 30 years? And your answer, without even blinking, was property rights.
Yeah, because that was the number one thing that changed when they basically gave up on socialism around 1980. And when Deng Xiaoping essentially came to power, he was faced with a pile of unusable leftover, what's the word? Shreds of capital, but that's not the right word. Remnants of basically they used up all the capital. It was all gone. And so he decided we got to rebuild. And how do we do that? Well, we have to encourage people to accumulate capital. And how you do that? Well, it's by respecting property rights. If you don't respect property rights, people are not going to accumulate capital. And that goes another discussion about what is capitalism. But I always say that this word is actually a really important word because one central tenet of capitalism that's often overlooked is the need to accumulate capital. By capital, we're not talking about money. We're talking about productive hardware that enables you to produce things in a more efficient way and make your society wealthy by using these means of production. That's capital. Also the capital in people's minds, know-how, it's all capital, right? And we have to accumulate capital. And how do you accumulate capital? Well, it's by respecting people's ownership of it. And if you don't respect their ownership of it, people are going to waste it and destroy it. And that's, of course, what happened in all the socialist countries, in China as well. So that was the number one thing they did. And there is, even today, even though it's eroded a bit from the Deng Xiaoping ideal, still even today, you can see in China, I have one near where I live, you can see houses on the side of the road that are where the road has been built around the house. Why? Well, because in China, there's no expropriation law. I think in the U.S. is called eminent domain, where they can basically, government can come and say, well, you know, we want your land, you have to sell it to us. Well, China doesn't have that law. So if they want to build a road or a motorway through some area and there's somebody has houses in the middle, the government can't just say, well, you have to leave. They have to buy them out. And if they don't sell, well, they have to build the road around them. So that's just an example. Unfortunately, there has been a decline in respect for property rights in some areas in China. I won't go into that, but generally speaking, the respect for property rights is higher than certainly in the U.S. The U.S. is one of the more extreme examples on the other side, where you have what's that called? What do they call in the U.S. where they can basically take your money without even having due process? What's that called? They say they catch you carrying $1,000. They say, well, we think that might be drug money, so let's take it first, and then you can ask for it back if you can prove where you got it from. They can do that in a number of states in the U.S., but that's U.S. is one of the only countries in the world you can do it without due process in the West, in the industrialized world. So that's kind of the exact the very opposite of what goes on in China. The other thing that they changed was they went from centralization to decentralization. They decentralized their government decision-making as much as possible, push it down to the local level and to the provincial level, and let them decide on their policies as much as possible. And that created competition between the provinces and the states, provinces and the localities, to offer the best conditions for entrepreneurs and also for their citizens. And that was a very positive thing. So, when you talk about centralization versus decentralization, on the higher, more abstract level, we're talking about essentially central planning versus decentralized planning. And decentralized planning means, if you take it to the very smallest unit, it means individual families, individual companies, letting them make the decisions. And if you go all the way back, you get the total centralized planning, the government, the national government, the big capital with its army of bureaucrats, them deciding. And for a good 20 years, let's say between 1990 and 2010, for the most part, and that's what was going on in China. Basically, the government said, you know, do your own thing and figure out how to finance it and make up your own decisions about what to produce. And that worked very well. And that's, in fact, I would argue, is what made China the second most important factor, which made China rich. Unfortunately, as we've discussed before, in many cases that hasn't stayed the same. And, as the China's become richer, the government has decided that, well, they have all this wealth now, so maybe we can do a little bit more planning. And they've gone back to dallying with central planning, and they've started to massively subsidize certain industries, like, for example, the EV industry. The results would have been as any Austrian economist would be able to predict, and that is terrible. So yes, they do dominate the EV industry worldwide because their cost reduction, their skill, their what's that word? Not cost reduction. Their economies of scale are so high. Sorry. That they're able to produce much more cheaply than anyone else. But almost, I think with one exception, all the EV companies are all losing money. So it's not sustainable. And the government is also losing money. So the government's investing all this money. Various groups of local governments or provincial governments have essentially through their investment funds have invested in these companies, and they're all competing each other to death. So it's kind of, in a way, it's sort of typical China, lots of competition, but there wouldn't be all this competition if the government weren't subsidizing them. Anyway, so only to say nothing good lasts forever. And what made China rich is now, unfortunately, in part being I wouldn't say forgotten, but being ignored. And those factors are declining. But this is actually something that's relatively unappreciated in the appreciated in the West, where you tend to get more sort of the opposite storyline, namely that China is a state capitalist, and that China does all this wonderful planning, and or it, as we've discussed before, because they're quote unquote communists, because they call themselves the Communist Party. They're these wonderful planners, and they're beating the West because they're such wonderful planners. Well, as I would say to that, if that were the case, then why weren't they beating the West 40 years ago, right? Why are all these peasants starving when Mao was running the show here? Then the state was planning everything, and it was a complete disaster. Well, no, of course, the central plan doesn't work and never has worked. And to the extent that they're trying to do that again here in China, it's not working. So... when people in the West say, oh, yes, we need to learn from China, let's do more planning, that's like completely the opposite of reality, right? That's to the extent that things are not going well in China, that's what's causing the problems of China today, is this too much central planning. But if you want to study learn from China, well, then do what China did well, which was stimulating competition, having respect for property rights, and decentralizing decisions out there. And but of course that those lessons are not being propagated in the West. So, you know, learning from China, that's not going to work by that measure.
So okay, so what you're saying to me then is that, weirdly enough, in the last 30 years or so, China followed more of an Austrian school of economics way than, say, the U.S.
Yes, definitely. But they also, because of their situation, they were in a way forced to, because they needed to accumulate capital. There was very limited access to capital, so they had to find some way to do it. And they did get lots of investment from the West, but they needed it too, because they started from such a low starting point. But at the end of the day, the investment from the West was only one factor. It was the internal competitive environment, and of course the low time preference of the Chinese people in general, their willingness to save large percentages of their income. But also, for example, in tandem with that, the lack of a welfare state in China. And China never had a welfare state, at least not since under socialism it did in theory, but in reality, of course, that meant everyone was equally bitterly poor. Now China has a little bit more of a welfare state than it did, but still the amounts are pretty low. So, you know, if you want to live off the government, it's not easy. And certainly, you know, compared with what types of offerings you have in Europe or even in the United States, it's very minimal. So people say, oh, you know, China's communist or whatever. Well, some people say that, but it doesn't have much of a welfare system. Everybody's working out there, right? So that's a big difference.
Would you say that China is fairly decentralized?
It certainly was 15 years ago. It's less so now than it was then. So certainly the central government has, in attempting to enforce more uniformity, it's introduced more national systems than were around 15 years ago. I mean, 15 years ago, basically none of the provincial systems communicated with each other at all. Every province had its own system. And even during COVID, for example, you know, there's lots of Orwellian discussions in the West about Chinese systems. But actually, in China, we had, there was this concept of this health code, but each province had its own health code. And in fact, in many cases, they had several different iterations of health codes. And the national government had its own health code, and none of them were compatible with each other. So it was just a complete chaos. But that was kind of typical of China, right? Not really coordinating things very well. Everybody was doing their own thing. And there were a lot of loopholes as a result, which is, I'd say, probably a good thing. But anyway, that was kind of that was in a way trying to kind of revert it back to the old standard of having everybody province doing its own thing. There's this old saying in China that the mountains are high and the emperor is far away. Well, there's some truth to that. But that's a good thing. I think all in all that provinces have been able to do their own thing and to come up with unique solutions and to facilitate competition between them. Less so now than before, but it's still there. And if you compare it to, let's say, the level of centralization of systems in the U.S., I'd say probably China is still more decentralized than the U.S. But every country is unique, of course. And you can't really say across the board because there's so many different aspects of that. But certainly decentralization has been a central tenet of Chinese governance in the last 40 years since 1985.
About 15 years ago or so, I started coming across individuals like Milton Friedman and Thomas Sowell. I often argue that Milton Friedman was sort of my gateway into Austrian economics thinking. I understand he came from, I think, the Chicago School of Economics or something to that effect, but whatever. I found his way of thinking pretty great. And then I stumbled across people like Ludwig von Mises and Murray Rothbard and Adam Smith. And there was another one now whose name escapes me. But I read a lot of their work, and it was very easy to follow. It wasn't this high-level, complicated economics. It was about down-to-earth reality and logic.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And it was focused on prosperity and freedom and liberty. Why on earth are these ideas so frowned upon by so many, do you think?
Uh-huh. That's really a deep question. Are they really frowned upon by so many? I would say that people are misguided. Many people are misguided. Because people need explanations about the world around them. And the truth is inconvenient for the powerful. And the powerful are the ones that control the schools and the media. So people have lack access to these to much of reality. And because they lack that access, they are misled, I would say, to promote, to have faith in ideas like socialism, like we should redistribute the wealth, right? Or we should steal from Peter to pay Paul, or however the thing goes. Instead of looking at the real source of the problem, which is the ongoing massive theft, to go back to where we really started with, all the time through this money printing, which is, I would argue, the real source of the problem. But we can't talk. They have never heard this in their life, where they think it's some technicality, right? Which is not, it's not involved. It's not involved. And instead of realizing that's really at the heart of all these things they don't like, the loss of freedom, the rising gap between the rich and poor that I mentioned before. And they look for other explanations. But do they really reject these ideas of freedom? I don't think so. I think they know that things are not as they have the gut feeling that things could be much better. And they lack the context and the information to explain those things. And it's because of that, they grasp at straws, I would say. And then of course, the powers that be, the powerful give them these straws. They give them these, they say, look, here, I have an explanation for you. Look, if you just agree to tax everybody to death and increase the surveillance systems and so on, then everything will be better. Or let's attack Iran and that will resolve the problem or whatever. Or let's blame the immigrants. You know, there are all these different explanations instead of getting at the things that they don't want to talk about.
But do you think that there is a kind of forced dichotomy between the idea of sovereignty, which requires a strong state, and the Austrian economic way of thinking, which prefers decentralization and less state interference?
It's a good question. I think that at the end of the day, the ideal world, of course, would be a world of voluntary interaction, voluntary exchange. And that goes back to what we talked about at the beginning, which is the difference between the political means and the economic means. So if everyone were happy with using the economic means to live together, this would not be an issue. Then we wouldn't have to worry about the whole sovereignty concept. But if significant members of society or people in power are not satisfied with that and they wish to live by the political means, meaning to obtain things by theft and force, then that's not going to work. So if for example, if you want to have a free hand to take things by force, then free trade is not going to work for you. So, you know, we can talk about an ideal world, a realistic world. We can say an ideal world is one in which you don't have that issue because people will all choose to trade freely amongst each other and not rob each other. But that's not the reality we have, right? I mean, we know that we live in a world dominated by force where the powerful take what they can. And the meek must put up with what they must, or some phrase saying like that along those lines. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that if you, I mean, it's to be more concrete about it, really the crux of the issue is these days is the discussion about the dependency on China. And I think that the people who run the West have come to the conclusion that their 10-year long campaign to decouple from China is at this point hopeless. They really tried very hard to decouple their industry from China to decrease their dependence on China. This started back under the Obama regime back in 2014. They were already paying subsidies to have manufacturers leave China. Didn't work out at all, really. It was a complete failure. But the intent was clearly there to try and decouple. The problem is it didn't work because you know, you can give sort of a very high level. You can say, oh, you know, CEO XYZ, you need to do this. But CEO XYZ also has to survive and produce profits. And so he's ultimately somewhere down the supply chain is going to go back to the best source, best suppliers, and those are often suppliers from China. So they tried for a long time, and eventually they realized not only does it not work, but their entire military supply chain is completely dependent on China. So if they want to keep making their missiles and munitions and tanks, then they have to keep up a open relationship, a reasonably, what's the word? Peaceful relationship with China. So is there any route back to sovereignty for the West? I don't know. I'd say it's tough because they've had this understanding with the Chinese leadership for 20, 30 years that allowed China to massively undervalue its currency and allowed the West to overvalue its currency, which is what created these huge imbalances to start with. And of course, this is only possible because of the money printing, right? It's only possible because China prints up an enormous amount of money every year to buy all those dollars and euros, right? If they weren't doing that, it wouldn't be possible. So this whole imbalance could not be sustained. But at the same time, in the West, they print up theoretical dollars and euros to pay China, in theory, to pay for all this stuff, right? So this huge imbalance is being sustained by the system, but they're all addicted to it, right? So all this talk about sovereignty, it makes sense. You can see where it's coming from. But realistically, in the medium term, I don't see how they're going to fix that. It looks looks hopeless to me. On the other hand, you know, at some point, something, like I said, I've said often before, something has got to give. I mean, the imbalances are getting bigger and bigger every year. I think last year China had a trade surplus of $1.2 trillion, right? And it's getting bigger every year. Somebody said, so what is the rest of the world supposed to do? We all serve each other coffee and China makes all the stuff, right? I mean, this is getting ludicrous, right? So that something's got to give here at some point. I don't know what will happen, but I know it's not sustainable. But in any case, this in a way, it's I think it's a good thing, because this theoretical idea of sovereignty really boils down to the ability to attack each other and make war. That's really what it's all about, right? So if we don't have this sovereignty, then that limits the ability to make wars. And I think I think we could argue that it's a good thing.
I, as you know, spent some time on your side of the world last year. And coming from South Africa, in the same 30-year period, we haven't really moved forward. I think we should implement a lot of that sort of decentralized thinking that China implemented over the last 30 years. I think it would help us a great deal.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, it's not just that. It's also, you know, the other thing we talked about is respect for property rights in general. I think that's that is also on an abstract level. It's not individual property rights. It's only individual property rights, but it's also company property rights, for example. And when a state, for example, enforces a monopoly, when they favor large companies through regulatory regimes, that's essentially impacting the property rights of smaller companies. And that's what you have going on throughout the West, in particular in the United States and in Western Europe, where most of the larger companies are all controlled by BlackRock, State Street, and Vanguard, which are essentially the same thing. And as a result, you have very limited competition in very many industries. And that's one of the things we don't have in China. We don't have that we have roughly 25% the companies under, in terms of added value, under government control, but that's far less than you have in the West. That's under the control of BlackRock, and that really limits competition in the West, because you ultimately, the CEOs of Delta and United and Air France, they probably all report back to BlackRock. So then it really limits how much real competition can you have under those types of circumstances. So that's really that. If you talk about property rights, yes, but ultimately what made China rich was providing for allowing competition to take place and allowing, of course, at the same time, cooperation between companies and individuals as they saw fit. But that competitive element has really suffered in the West in the last 20 or 30 years. You have a level of centralized control that's really only comparable with the Soviet Union. And people don't see that, because the difference between the West today and the Soviet Union is that the Soviet Union, the government tried to control everything. But the West today is an improved version. They realize they're not going to be able to control all the small companies and medium-sized companies. So they just concentrate on controlling the big ones, right? It's a much superior model to the old Soviet model, which didn't work at all. It was a disaster. But still, you have that basic problem that these large companies, their level of innovation and competitiveness is limited. So take, for example, a company like Cisco. Cisco has never added a single job for anything. They just keep buying up companies with all that cheap money that they have access to. But they consume these companies and they stop innovating once they get bought. And they got bought out. No, so I got my money and I made, you know, whatever. Now I can retire. And their companies sort of limp along as part of this Cisco blob. But they don't really create any jobs. Of course, same thing we have here in China. State companies in China don't create any jobs at all. They're a black hole. They're not innovative. They don't create jobs. And it's only the private sector that does that, right? The real private sector. And in the West, the real private sector is the small and medium-sized enterprises. But because the entire large company sector is all dominated by BlackRock, it really hampers the competitiveness of the economy. And that's, I would say, that's ultimately the reason why China is so competitive, is because we have much more competition here than the West. So the West can't compete.
Yeah, let me give an example, an anecdote of that competitiveness that you are referring to. So I bought a pair of cheap canvas shoes from Temu, which is, for those who don't know, it's a Chinese app. It's like a huge shopping app. It arrived after a couple of days, and it was one size too small. So it was dropped off here in the afternoon. On the app, I said the shoes are too small. The next morning, right, the courier pitches up at my front door and says, "We're collecting the Temu purchase."
That's great!
Wait, within 5 minutes after they had taken the shoes from me, the app sent me a notification saying that I had a full refund. I mean, now that's better service than what I get here.
Well, that's Chinese efficiency for you, and that's because of the what's the adjective used with competition? The cutthroat competition here. That's really what it is. And here, you have all these different apps offering that type of service. You're not satisfied, send it back immediately. We'll come, somebody picks it up, exchange it, whatever. It's all extremely efficient. And that's really ultimately goes back to competition. I will say, however, though, here, we're also suffering from a lessening of that because of the government bureaucracy, which makes it more difficult than it was before to compete with, you know, the big platforms that offer these types of services. For a new one to come to rise up and compete with them, it gets more and more difficult because of government bureaucracy. But still, it's still much better than the West. So, that's something where the West could definitely learn from China. I'm not sure if that's the moral of the story, but it's only one of them. And China could learn from itself how things were going on here 10 years ago. One of the interesting point though to make here is that China has actually done a lot with infrastructure, and I will say a lot of the infrastructure in China is very impressive, and the government has invested enormous funds in infrastructure projects, in roads and high speed rail and so on. And at least I would say to their defense, at least it's better than building bombs and missiles, right? At least it's somewhat useful, right? But it has, of course, it has drowned out, it has sucked away resources from the other parts of the economy. And in so far, to that extent, it's all somewhat of a drain, and it results in many fewer resources going to other sectors. What I mentioned earlier about lack of investment in other sectors in China, unless the government happens to be subsidizing it. Ultimately, even though the government has a much larger role now in the Chinese economy than it did 10 years ago, still, let's say the ways of competition and capitalism are very sticky. That's not the right word, but they're very stubborn. It takes a long time for the government interference to really wear down an economy. You saw that also in the West as well, where you have all these ways in which government interferes in the economy and slows things down. But still, the economy keeps going forward. It takes a long time to wear it down completely. And in China, even though the government is working on wearing it down and interfering with the economy and creating problems, it's still at a lesser level than it is in the West, significantly. So that's a big difference you see here. Between what's going on here and what's going on in the West. Even though it's going backwards here, the gap is still pretty big, and China is still much, much more competitive than the West. And ironically, what I mentioned earlier about the lack of investment is in itself also creating more pressure on companies to be competitive because of the lack of investment inside China. So people have to be super, super efficient and always come up with, and little particularly medium sized, always come with new ideas to be more innovative, so have to create new innovative products because the competition is so intense. But that's the way it should be, right? And everybody benefits from that ultimately. And I think that's certainly one moral of the story, that's the type of prosperity that a wealthy society should be giving to everyone in the society.
All right, Scott, your group Substack is austriandchina.substack.com. Is that correct?
Yes, we're not too active on that there these days, but definitely sign up. And every now and then we write a useful article in English, so please, by all means.